Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
All right. Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg. And once again, I have the pleasure of being joined at the table with Andre Kleiner.
And my pleasure is to be here as well.
Appreciate it. Yeah. And you know, the format of the Speaking of Reliability is really a conversation across the table with somebody that's new to reliability engineer or wants to, you know, just think about a topic. And that started here at RAMS. We happen to be sitting at a table at RAMS where this all started. So you, in the recording, you're going to maybe hear some of the background noise and the activity in the cafeteria or cafe or bar we're sitting at.
And RAMS being Reliability and Maintainability Conference.
That's right.
just to clarify.
That's right. And what you? How long have you been coming to RAMS?
Since early 2000.
Okay.
So it's been almost 15 years, but I it was kind of on and off. So most of the time I come here on even year.
That's right.
Like 08, 10, 12, and so on.
Well, a little bit earlier this morning, Andre and I had the chance to sit down with Carolyn Lubert, who's the tutorials chair. I was going to call her the tutorials czar. I don't think that would have worked. And so I'll put links in the show notes to the other sessions we recorded here at RAMS and other participants we talked to. But Andre and I, we haven't had a chance to really talk about in the Speaking of Reliability. Now, I hope you become a regular member of the program.
I'll try.
Okay.
Certainly.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold you to that. And if I see you next year at RAMS, we'll have to record a year's worth. So if I don't get too many. But one of the questions we run into regularly, and I know you've run into this too,
oh, yeah,
Andre, is this topic of to what degree, if you have an environmental stress, temperature,
yeah, that's a good example, or vibration.
And it's a continuous scale. You know that it's not the minimum and the maximum in your specifications. The 45C ambient air happens in some parts of the world for some periods of time, but most of our products are not in that all the time. So testing at the extreme or the absolute maximum air temperature ever on Earth recorded, right?
In the past 200 years,
in the past, right? 200 years since we had thermometers, is probably not what we test to. It's a continuous scale. It goes from melting everything we know how to build to nominal ambient average air. And so there's some, I'd always like, if you can get the prototype working at ambient, at just room temperature, that's usually a good sign. But very soon, somebody's going to say, we need to see if it works, because we know one of our customers is going to drive this in the high desert near, we're in Tucson in summertime. And I think air temperature here gets to over 100 Fahrenheit. But that's one of the things we run into often is, well, it's a continuous scale. How do you pick the right number to put on your thermal chamber or your test facility?
That's a very common question. In like when I teach systems engineering course and get to reliability, I ask student the question, okay, what condition you're going to test to? Because we have on one spectrum, and again, I work in the automotive industry, so people drive their cars totally differently, totally different fashion, different roads. It's like you have what we call a little old lady who drives her car on Sunday to the church. And on the other spectrum, we have a crazy pizza delivery guy who lives in rural area and drives nonstop over those gravel roads and God knows what kind of climate. So, and usually students say, oh, we test to a worst case. And then ask him a question. I mean, what is worst case?
What is worst case?
Yeah. What is worst case? I mean, is that like what Fred, you mentioned?
Do you have a bunch of pizza delivery guys in your class?
Yeah. So it goes back to what Fred mentioned. It's like a worst temperature ever recorded in this area, and probably not. Correct?
It's just because it happened for an hour, you know, one time and one vehicle failed at that. Is that the new standard?
No. And again, as a, in our previous discussion, the cost comes into consideration. And again, what I tell to the students, can you design a Geo Metro for Shaquille O'Neal? Because he's like this 99.9, probably 9 percentile size guy. Can you fit him in a small car? And the answer, of course not.
Yeah, well, and make him comfortable. I think you could get him in there, maybe 1.5 of him in there. But some of it is that it's a distribution. The yes. temperature comes on a distribution, and we have the fortune with temperature weather things that there's weather stations all over the world. We can collect that data and take a look at it. Or you can instrument cars. And track. We used to do that with inkjet printers. Is they would do 1,000 units that they would instrument and hand, basically give to customers and have them use it. And it helped us understand temperature, humidity, which affected drying time, how long the paper had to wait until it would drop the next page down. It affected a number of different failure mechanisms. Was on how often you printed or not printed.
So you collect as much field data as possible, trying to characterize all those environments right. out there.
And instead of having, here's my specification that goes on the data sheet, and just test to that, which is, I see plenty of people start with just that, and then some will go, well, we'll test a little bit beyond. And then is that covering all of the risk you're dealing with? Or, you know, if you need to understand where we used to run a test at HP that was, we called it the four corners test.
Oh, like four extreme.
It was temperature and humidity. So think of temperature on the x-axis. So we're engineers, right, Andre? So we need a piece of paper. Well, if I think of it and remember, we'll have to add a little sketch of this on the show notes. But so temperature on the horizontal axis and humidity on the vertical axis.
Yeah, we do the same in the automotive, only instead of humidity, we have voltage.
Right, for your electronics.
Yeah, yeah
right.
for electronics. Yeah, so
right. So you make a plot like that, and the four corners test, I think it came from some mill standard, it said you have cold and low humidity, and you have low humidity and hot, which is dry desert heat kind of thing here in Tucson, and then there's low temperature and high humidity, which
yeah,
rarely...
You basically look at all the possible
the
kind
four
of extreme combinations, yes.
Right? But I don't know of very many places that cold and high humidity, because yeah. atmospherically that's difficult to do, and then there's hot and humid. And so most people could immediately identify with cold and dry, because that happens across North America fairly frequently. When the air gets cold, the moisture content goes way down. And so a lot of our climate is in that realm. And then there's a whole pile that are up in Florida and the deep south where it's hot and humid.
So basically you say your square now becomes kind of just two-corner
Well, it
test.
Became, so what we did is we went and...
Which makes sense.
Right, so after we gathered the data and you plotted where people used it and the type of experience the printer saw over the year, it made like a sausage pattern between those two
yeah,
lower left
the
upper right.
Yeah, I was looking for the right geometry, yeah. So your square become a sausage.
Yeah, or you know, a very flat oval is that description. And so when we saw that, we're like, why are we testing way out there with the cold and dry, or cold and humid, or the hot and dry? And because very few people actually operate the equipment in those realms, in those areas. And if you, then we had enough data that we could plot with the percentiles. So we knew where 90% of the population was. We knew where 95% of the people were. We knew where 99%.
Yeah, and that's probably the way to go. Yeah, you'll never, nothing is 100%. And you don't want 100% because that's when you're going to be hitting those extreme, like, ever recorded temperatures.
Well, we could design something to survive that.
Yeah, but
nobody
it's probably
going to
be cost.
It.
Yeah, probably it's going to be cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
So yeah, and but it, sometimes you run into a situation where like, okay, we're trying to characterize a temperature. Again, this is probably easiest to talk about. But then you look at the map of the United States and you have regions where like it gets very cold, you have regions where it gets really hot. And then the whole process becomes a little more complicated. How to generate that distribution where you like, if once you have a distribution, you're good.
Right.
You're golden, basically.
That's right.
So you can look and say, okay, this is my 90th percentile, is my 95th percentile. But just collecting the right data and basically presenting them right way, that also may be a little bit of a challenge.
It really can be. When we were using temperature, just to throw in another example is, My office in HP, across the hall from me, was an engineer that worked on shipping, packaging of components and products and like laptops that they would survive getting from the factory to the store and from store home. So the box, basically. He was a carton engineer, for lack of a better term. And this was 20 years ago, but he would install these really small, thin, lightweight data loggers in the packages, and then he would ship it through the FedEx
and
system.
And recording the whole way. And the University of Maryland used to do the same thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he had little accelerometers in there, and he was looking at the shock and vibration
when the thing gets dropped.
When it gets dropped. And he didn't send out a lot of them, but it was a significant sample. And he would ship these things to different locations and have folks gather the instruments up and send them back. Nowadays, you could do it all on wireless transmitting. If you could get the sensor and logger cheap enough, you could throw them away. But the idea was that he collected all of this information and then laid down the patterns of the vibration profiles for the different shipping channels. And that became the basis for our test standards.
Yeah, and I guess that's what it boils down to. When you need to collect good data, and being able to process this. In this case, and sometimes it's a problem because, again, going back to the automotive industry, it becomes driven by standards. Written by GMs and Toyotas.
Your friends.
and Toyotas of the world. And in many cases, those standards, those requirements, really not based on any data collected from the field. And in fact, with what I see every year, they keep kind of cranking up those requirements because what happens is something happens in the field, and something always does, and say, okay, we didn't test this hard enough, so let's...
Some manager usually says, why didn't we catch that?
Yeah.
And the test engineer says, well, if we used higher stresses, we'd have a better chance of finding that mechanism. Yeah. But you're right. I've seen that happen in a drop test, which kind of made sense to me because they had almost no data of how there was the luggage tag reader that they used at the airports. You'd see the guys with this device. Most of what you see is padding because of it gets thrown and dropped and run over and all that stuff. And last time I worked with them, they were dropping these things from 15 feet onto hard concrete. And they would drop it to failure. And so they were dropping 50, 60, and sometimes 150 times. And then they would analyze the failures, the accumulated damage that came from that. But they started with 10 drops at 4 feet. And then they saw field failures, and then they increased the height, and they got field failures, and they increased the height. But there was a correlation. The higher they went, the fewer failures they got.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of empirically ran into the right place. Now, on the other hand, if we could have instrumented, say, 100 prototypes and got them in a trial run and measured the drops, it would have given them a better idea of what profile they were trying to measure to.
Yeah. Well, interesting aspect about testing to extreme conditions. And as I mentioned before, in most of the automotive specs kind of require you testing to between 95th percentile and some actually go as high as 99.5 percentile.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is to me is a little extreme.
Some of these get some long tails, so that gets way out there.
Yeah. But again, not all of those OEMs have the data, I mean, real data, where they're extracting this from. Well, another interesting aspect of testing to extreme conditions is actually the demonstrated reliability, something we covered in other discussions. Because mm-hmm. if, let's say, we demonstrate 97% reliability. But again, keep in mind, we're testing to extreme conditions. So this, we demonstrated to the parts which actually will see those conditions. But in the whole population, most of the parts will not see that. So there's a way to actually, and I wrote the paper on that, where you can convert reliability demonstrated at, let's say, 99th percentile testing to the whole population, and that reliability will be much, much higher than what you demonstrated.
Right. And I think that's the kind of a common sense interpretation of doing that.
And everybody understands that, but until you actually have those formulas in place and say, okay, so basically my 97% reliability at this extreme condition translates into 99.5% reliability for the whole population, which will see different type of environments, until you have that and you can show it to the customer, I mean, they will say, yeah, we understand that, but we don't know what's the real number you're demonstrating.
That's right.
So that was the reason, actually, I put together this, wrote this paper and actually put together
was
this.
Was that something we can point to some way? Or I know we can put the...
Yeah, it's been published last year.
Okay, so we can add it to the show notes and we have to remember that.
And we already, like in my everyday work, we're already getting some mileage out of this because now we have customers who have that common sense, but they didn't know how to basically...
How to use it for their work and their decisions.
But now we have all the mathematics going into this.
Cool. Well, I think it's going to get... Well, earlier today, I was talking to one of the participants, Adam Barrett, and I were talking to him. And he's at a university in Germany. And they're collecting data that's collected by the car. So the different chips and different controller units are in there collecting lots of information. And they're downloading that information. And it's sounded like big data analysis, looking for patterns. But one part of the goal was to characterize how people drive. How many times do you accelerate with so much force? How many times do you do this? How many times do that?
It's very important, because again, those standards or requirements we get from the customers, we know they're not based on actual data because collecting data is expensive and nobody wants to spend money these days.
And it's getting less and less expensive. The data loggers and some of the data is already there. It's just somebody has to collect it and analyze it. So it sounded like his program and the students he's got are being... basically as consultants to do this analysis of these. And it sounded like he had some great math background.
Yeah, but that's a good trend. There. It's a good trend because what I've seen was reverse trend because, let's say, GM used to have a group which was called PUMA, which stands for...
Something.
product measurements, usage, something like that, and which contained people who would drive vehicles and collect the data. And they disbanded that group in 1998 because
it was... So you went for 10, 20 years with not a lot of data being collected.
Yeah, and I know for a fact that not too many car makers have this kind of groups who would do that. So they still rely on... I still have reports in my possession which were put together by GM like in late 80s, early 90s. With a lot of useful information. They analyze all this environment, they collect temperature data at different locations in the car, like what's going to be your maximum temperature under your seat, or in the headliner, or in your trunk.
I understand that the rear tail light on the back window, that because it's an enclosure and the glass, that can get pretty hot inside there.
Yeah, and they would park their cars like in Tucson, for example,
in the sun.
Yeah, and it's just to see what's happening. And like, to the best of my knowledge, not too many people do that anymore.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we're getting lots of data. There's a role for statisticians after all, sir. We're coming into our due. Yeah. Well, thanks, Andre. Well, I think we're coming up on lunch, so I think it's going to get really noisy here. So we'll probably have to wrap up for a little bit.
Yeah, and thanks to Fred for doing all those recordings and posting them and kind of promoting this reliability education for for us reliability professionals.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, as a listener, let us know if you've got any questions. While we're here at RAMS, we're asking people and trying to find what you'd like to hear. So you can, on the show notes at reliability.fm, you can find comments and ways to give us some ideas or feedback, or get in contact with us directly. We'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening. Thanks, Andre.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.